I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Reza Aslan is an internationally acclaimed writer and scholar of religions, and his new book is now number one on the New York Times bestseller list, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Reza spent 20 years researching this book. His first book was an international bestseller as well, No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam, named one of the 100 most important books of the last decade. He was born in Iran. He's associate professor of creative writing and affiliated faculty in the Department of Religion at the University of California, Riverside. He has also taught at the University of Iowa, Drew University, and other places. He writes early in the book, why it's important to find the real Jesus. He says if we expose the claims of the Gospels to the heat of historical analysis, we can purge the scriptures of their literary and theological flourishes and forge a far more accurate picture of the Jesus of history. If we commit to placing Jesus firmly within the social, religious, and political context of the era in which he lived, an era marked by the slow burn of a revolt against Rome that would forever transform the faith and practice of Judaism, then in some ways his biography writes itself. We'll be welcoming phone calls, I'm sure, because this book has received so much attention that a good many of you have had a chance to read it. It is absolutely fascinating. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor, thank you ever so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be back on the show.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. You write early in the book that you hope that the book will spread the good news of the Jesus of history with the same fervor that you once applied to this, to spreading the story of Christ. And yet the Jesus of history is kind of hard to find, isn't he, unless you look at the times?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, outside of the New Testament, we have very little information about Jesus of Nazareth. I mean, mostly our information comes from what little can be gleaned from the historical documents that were written primarily in the second century, so, you know, almost 100 years after Jesus had died. But we do know a lot about the world in which Jesus lived. First century Palestine, thanks to the Romans, who were very good at documentation. And so what I try to do is take what little we know about Jesus, that what little there is, I would say, consensus on regarding him, which is that he was a Jew, that he lived sometime at the beginning of the first century, that he started a Jewish movement, the purpose of which was to establish the kingdom of God on earth, and that as a result of that movement, he was crucified as a state criminal by Rome. My argument is that if you take those few things and you place them in the world that Jesus lived, then his biography kind of writes itself. And the image that is revealed by that historical exercise is of a Jesus that bears very little resemblance to the kind of celestial spirit, these inveterate pacifist who has no concern with the cares of this world, that many Christians have of him.
What is the fervor you have for the Jesus of history? Why do you have such strong fervor for that man?
Well, part of it has to do with my first introduction to Jesus. I first heard the gospel message at an evangelical youth camp when I was a teenager, and it had a profound effect on my life. I became an evangelical Christian. I spent the next few years preaching the gospel of Christ. When I went to college and began to study the New Testament in an academic environment, I was confronted with this reality that there was this great chasm between the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith. Mm-hmm. And although I abandoned Christianity, I continued my academic studies in the New Testament and sort of looked at Jesus with a fresh set of eyes, no longer burdened with the baggage of dogma or doctrine. I was able to just see him for who he was. And who he was an illiterate, uneducated, marginal poor peasant from the backwoods of Galilee who, despite having everything stacked against him, using only his charisma and the remarkable power of his teachings, managed to gather a movement to him that was so threatening to the religious and political powers in its vision of a new world order, a world in which the social order is turned on its head, where the weak become strong and the strong become weak, the poor become wealthy and the wealthy become poor, the first will be last and the last will be first, that he was ultimately seized and tortured and executed for it. Whatever else you want to say about Jesus, well, however else you think of him, that's a man worth knowing.
Yes, it is. What is it that places him apart from the many messiahs you write about in the book, people who claim they were messiahs? This was an era when there were a lot of them, weren't there?
Right, yeah. It's an era that's awash in apocalyptic expectation. You have dozens of preachers and prophets and wonder workers, miracle workers, many of whom refer to themselves as messiah, walking around healing the sick, casting out demons, talking about the kingdom of God, railing against the Roman occupation, promising divine deliverance from Rome. And almost all of these characters were ultimately executed for treason as a result of their movements. And Jesus very much fits into that larger category, but you are right. You can't ignore the fact that out of all those other messiahs, only one of them, 2,000 years later, is still called Messiah. And that's a significant fact that I try to wrestle with in the book. And I guess the short answer to it is that it has less to do with anything that Jesus himself said or did, though his words and actions were remarkable, than it did with what his followers said about him after his death.
So you couldn't be a messiah if you died.
Well, I mean, look, Messiah means something fairly specific in first century Palestine. I mean, the Messiah is the anointed one. He is the descendant of King David. His chief task is to recreate the kingdom of God on earth and therefore to usher in the rule of God, the reign of God. A dead Messiah is, by the Jewish definition, no longer the Messiah. And indeed, every other Messiah who made that claim and was killed for it was viewed as a quote-unquote failed Messiah. Now, here's the uncomfortable fact about Jesus, is that according to the definitions of the Messiah brought forward by Judaism, Jesus was as successful as any one of those other Messiahs. He did not recreate the kingdom of David. He did not free the Jews from the yoke of Roman occupation. And so, by all accounts, his followers should have done what the followers of all the other messiahs did, which is to just abandon the movement and go home.
Yes.
But they didn't. And that's the important thing. They stuck around because they said that they had this mystical experience of the risen Jesus. And that experience spurred them to redefine what Messiah means, to make it no longer a Jewish office, but to turn it into something else, something unique, innovative.
And also to redefine the circumstances of the birth of Jesus, how he was born, whether or not there was a virgin birth, whether or not he had brothers and sisters, whether or not he could read or write, all of that. Let's start with his early life, because I haven't heard this very much, that he had lots of brothers and probably quite a few sisters. One of his brothers, extremely important, and if people had followed him instead of Paul, the church might have been remarkably different. Can you talk about his family and why we have, instead of Nazareth, we have Bethlehem, and why we have Mary, and some are later on, as you write about, saying that he is thought of as from the house of Mary instead of Joseph, leading people to really wonder about what the circumstances of his birth were.
Yes, I mean, look, the Gospels make it very clear that Jesus came from a very large Jewish peasant family. It names four of his brothers. It says that he had a number of sisters, though unfortunately they are not named. And you're right. One of his brothers, James, becomes the leader of the movement that Jesus leaves behind after his death. He's referred to as the Bishop of Bishops. He is the head of the mother assembly in Jerusalem. So in other words, you could think of it as kind of the home church which is then in charge of all the other different assemblies or churches that arise in other parts of the Roman Empire. And yes, this incredibly important man, James, the brother of Jesus, more or less gets excised from Christian history after the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, and we can talk about why that is a little bit later. But I think you're right. The problem with Jesus is that until he is declared Messiah, and perhaps more specifically, until his followers declare him to be God, nobody cares what kind of childhood this itinerant Jewish peasant
right.
had.
Right.
And so all of those stories have to be created after the fact, many, many years later, decades later. And the purpose of those stories is not to reveal any kind of historical fact about Jesus. The purpose of those stories are to reveal this very important truth about who he was. He's the Messiah, therefore he has to be born in the city of David, which is Bethlehem. So he can't be a Nazarene. We have to get him to Bethlehem some way. And so Luke creates this entire story about this census that forces his family to uproot themselves and go to Bethlehem instead. It's an unhistorical story, but Luke doesn't care about what we refer to as history. He's trying to make a larger point about who Jesus was, the anointed descendant of David. That's how we're supposed to read the childhood stories. And the fact of the matter is that until Jesus' ministry starts on the banks of the Jordan River when he is baptized by John, we know nothing about his life up to that moment.
Mm-hmm. Rosa Aslan, why do you call the book Zealot? What does it mean for Jesus to have been a zealot?
Zealotry was a widespread phenomenon in Jesus's time. It actually has its roots in a biblical doctrine called zeal. All the great heroes and prophets and kings of the Hebrew Bible, or the Old Testament as it's sometimes called, were known to be zealous for the Lord. Zeal, according to the Bible, implies a strict devotion to the Torah, the law of Moses, an uncompromising fidelity to the sole sovereignty of God, a refusal to serve any master, certainly any human master, but any master at all, save the master of the universe. In Jesus' time, the vast majority of Jews would have proudly referred to themselves as zealous for the Lord. But there were a handful of groups and individuals who took the concept of zealotry to its logical conclusion, which is that if you are committed to the sole sovereignty of God, then you cannot abide by the pagan, heathen, Roman occupation of God's land. After all, God makes it very clear in the Hebrew Bible that this is a land that is set aside for none but his chosen people. The Roman presence was an abomination to these zealots, and repeatedly throughout the first century, they rose up, spurred by zeal for the Lord, against the Roman Empire, and repeatedly the Roman Empire crushed them to the ground until, interestingly enough, in the year 66 AD, some 30-something years after Jesus died, when a group of zealots rise up again, and this time it works. They kick Rome out of the Holy Land. They manage to keep them at bay for about 3 or 4 years until 70 AD, when the Romans return and destroy the city of Jerusalem.
Yeah. And tell me about the death on the cross. You say that he would have been one of dozens of self-proclaimed messiahs trying to rally their followers to revolt against Roman rule. Many had larger reputations and followings, and almost all died on the cross because of their revolt against Roman rule?
Crucifixion was a punishment that Rome reserved exclusively for the crime of sedition or treason, crimes
really?
Against the state. Hmm. That was the only thing that you could be crucified for. People often bring up the fact that there were thieves who were crucified alongside Jesus, but of course they were not actually thieves. The word in Greek, lestes, doesn't actually mean thief. It means bandit. And bandit in Jesus' time was the most common term for an insurrectionist, for a rebel. Even Jesus is called a bandit, a lestes, in the Gospels. In other words, just the fact that Jesus was crucified, if you know nothing else about Jesus at all except that he was crucified, you know enough to at the very least question the widespread perception of him as this kind of inveterate pacifist with no interest in the cares of this world. If you were crucified, you were crucified because you revolted against the state.
You also, the book takes in so much, but the story, a lot of this is what happened after the death. So the story of Jesus is becoming less and less Jewish, you write, and the descriptions of him are becoming more and more pacifist. The writers of the gospel making a conscious decision to continually downplay not only his Jewishness, but also his revolutionary zeal, trying to convince the very people that Jesus had worked so hard to overthrow. Well, isn't that a turn of events, huh? I mean, really?
Perfectly. I mean, here's the thing. This event that I described in 70 AD, when the Romans return, they destroy Jerusalem, slaughter tens of thousands, if not 100,000 Jews, if you believe the historian Josephus. They raise the temple of God to the ground. What few Jews are left are exiled from the Holy Land. Judaism itself becomes a kind of pariah religion. It's no longer regarded as a legitimate cult in the Roman Empire. Jews, in fact, are now tasked with paying a yearly fee for the upkeep of the main pagan deity of Rome, the Temple of Jupiter. Now, here's what you need to know about what I just said. Every word ever written about Jesus in the Gospels was written after that event. The first Gospel of Mark was written probably sometime around 70 to 72 AD, so not long after that. Matthew and Luke were written probably between 90 and 100, and the Gospel of John was written somewhere between 100 and about 120. So when these Gospels are being written, they're no longer being addressed to a Jewish audience.
Right.
I mean, if you want this movement to succeed, you don't want to convert Jews to it. You want to convert Romans to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires three very important things. Number one, as you said it rightly, you have to make Jesus just a little less Jewish. Number two, you have to temper his revolutionary fervor. This is a man whose entire ministry was predicated on removing Rome from power. You can't convince Romans to follow that man unless you make him far less interested in those kinds of things. And then third and most importantly, you have to remove all blame for his death from Rome and instead place it on the heads of the Jews, which is precisely what happens in the Gospels, particularly in the last Gospel, John.
And who was the leader of all of that transformation? Would it be fair to say it was Paul?
Well, there were a number of Hellenistic Jews, Jews who spoke Greek, who lived in these cosmopolitan Roman cities like Tarsus in the case of Paul, or Alexandria, or Antioch, or even Rome, who adopt this movement and begin to fashion it, to kind of translate it into Roman and Hellenistic terms. But no question that the most prominent of them, and the one that we all remember the best, is this man, Paul, who never knew Jesus while Jesus was alive, but who has this mystical experience of the risen Jesus sometime around, let's say, 37, 38 AD, so about 7 or 8 years after Jesus died, and who designates himself as the missionary to the Gentiles. Paul sees his role as being, sees his role as sort of translating this deeply Jewish religion that's founded upon a Jew into terms that non-Jews can accept and understand. And it's Paul who begins this process of transforming Jesus from a peasant revolutionary into a kind of God-man, something that would have been really unfamiliar to Jesus and his original followers.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that you, there's so much in the book, but the other thing, you as a religious scholar and a historian spent so many years looking at the history of Jesus. It's too bad that nobody in those times thought very much about history, right? Because somebody needed to write more about his life, but that wasn't very important. The thought of history was completely different in the first century in Palestine.
That's absolutely correct. What we refer to today as history, the accumulation of empirically verifiable facts and figures, is wholly a product of the modern world. That definition of history is barely 300 years old. History in the ancient mind was not about uncovering facts. It was about revealing truths.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, mm-hmm. the gospel writers were, I would say less concerned, but even that doesn't make sense. But they were less concerned about saying what happened than in explaining what it meant. In other words, what they wanted to do was fashion stories about Jesus, the historicity of which may or may not be accurate. It really wasn't all that important to them, but whose larger truth, the explanation that it provided in helping you understand exactly who Jesus was and what he meant, was what mattered. That's how they thought of history. That's how we should understand the Gospels. I mean, I think this notion that the Bible is literal and inerrant is a very new phenomenon. The people who wrote the Gospels did not think what they were writing was literal and inerrant. The people who compiled the New Testament in the 4th century, the church fathers, did not think that what they were compiling was literal and inerrant. Otherwise, by the way, they never would have had four Gospels in the canon. I mean,
right.
These Gospels contradict each other
mm-hmm.
on a number of issues. You know, the day in which Jesus was born, his genealogy, his infancy stories. There are so many differences and contradictions between these Gospels. I think it would be ridiculous to think that the church fathers didn't realize that. Of course they did. They just didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
We're the only ones who care.
Mm. Well, we're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is the author of the now number one New York Times bestseller, Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. I'm interested in Reza's explanation as to why this book has just really taken off, too. I know he wrote it, but it says something about us, doesn't it, that this book is now being talked about so extensively in America. Reza Aslan is our guest. He is also the international best-selling author of No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. We interviewed him about that some time ago. Here's how you reach our conversation. We have a couple lines open right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. And you can always go to our Facebook page as well, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two phone calls now for our guest, Reza Aslan, who is the author most recently of Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. He is an internationally acclaimed writer and scholar of religion. And we go first to Joe in Waupaca. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call. Professor Aslan, it's a pleasure being able to talk to you. I have not read your book yet, but in reading some of other authors involved in sort of the historical Jesus, John Dominic Crossan and Elaine Pagels and Michael White, I'm sure you're familiar with their work. They seem to suggest, or at least in part, that Jesus may not have been, I think, as you indicate, a poor and illiterate man, that perhaps he may have been very literate, and living up in Nazareth, a little bit closer to Caesarea, am I pronouncing that right, the main Roman city? Wouldn't it make more sense that maybe he was educated and had some higher-level connections to be that zealot that you are suggesting?
Yeah, very, very good question. First of all, actually, a couple of the people that you mentioned do believe that Jesus was illiterate and a poor peasant. For instance, John Dominic Crossan, that's the Jesus that he understands. There's been a great deal of debate about Jesus for 200 years, and you know, my book is an attempt not just to enter that debate, but to sort of distill it as much as possible and provide an access to it for a popular reader who doesn't normally sit around in a dusty library somewhere, you know, poring through ancient documents. But the job of the historian in these debates is to talk about what is most likely and what is less likely. So let's talk about this illiteracy thing for a moment. So by the estimates of most scholars, people think that about 90 to 98% of the population of the first century Palestine was illiterate. So about 90 to 98%
Goodness.
Of Jesus' fellow Jews could not read or write. The only Jews who could read or write are the ones for whom it was a profession. So in other words, the temple priests, the scribes, the Pharisees. What we know about Jesus is that he was none of these things. So what the Bible says that Jesus was is a tecton. A tecton, which is often referred to as carpenter, more generally means woodworker or builder. And now, if that's true, if we take the Bible's word for it, that would place Jesus at about the second lowest rung of the social ladder in first century Palestine, just above the indigent, the slave, the beggar. In other words, it would make him what's known as a day laborer. A day laborer is somebody who has a trade and who goes around looking for someone to pay for his trade. The next thing that we know about Jesus is that he was called a Nazarene, which means that he lived in this village called Nazareth. Now, here's what we know about Nazareth. It's so small a town, it's so inconsequential that its name does not appear on any map or document before the end of the first century. This is a village of maybe 100 families at most. There were no roads in Nazareth, no public baths in Nazareth. We've yet to actually uncover evidence of there even being a synagogue in Nazareth. So what we do as a historian, we take all of those historical facts and we put them together, and do we say, is it likely that a poor Jewish day laborer who lives in a village called Nazareth in a society in which 90 to 98% of his fellow Jews could not read or write, is it more likely that Jesus somehow could read or write? Or is it more likely that he, like the majority of Jews in his time, also could not read or write? I think the answer to that is fairly clear. Mm. Some scholars disagree, and some scholars don't. But that's what's so fun about this conversation, is that, you know, it's a debate over historical fact.
Mm-hmm. I want to spend a little more time, and I want you to write your next book on James, because I find him absolutely fascinating.
Me too.
Yeah, and he's kind of been lost to history here. But here's somebody who was the brother of Jesus and who followed him. And there was something just utterly captivating about him, in that you write he had nothing. He owned nothing. He didn't even own the clothes on his back. He never cut his hair. He didn't take baths. He didn't cut his beard.
Never ate wine, never ate meat.
And so does that mean that probably Jesus was the same because he was following the path of Jesus?
Some scholars actually make that argument. A number of scholars that I admire greatly believe that Jesus himself was what's called a Nazarite. A Nazarite is a particularly devout, very strict Jew in Jesus' time. And the description that we have of James, that he wouldn't cut his hair or take baths or you know, eat the flesh of animals, those are all descriptions of a Nazarite. And there is an argument that Jesus was not from Nazareth, that he was actually a Nazarite, and that's where the confusion, Jesus of Nazareth, came from. It's an interesting argument. I personally don't agree with it, but I think it's one that has a lot of good things going for it. But what we can sort of extrapolate from James is that his vision of who Jesus was, a Jew who is talking about Judaism and who started a Jewish movement for other Jews, is probably more accurate, or at least more historically linked to Jesus, than the impression that James's nemesis, and I use this term deliberately because it's quite clear that these two people, these two gentlemen, did not like each other. They did not get along, James and Paul.
Right.
We see it in Paul's letters. We see it in the book of Acts. We see it in a series of documents called the Pseudo-Clementines that we have. But as opposed to Paul's vision of Jesus as a sort of universal figure that is sent for all nations, those two visions were in contrast to mm-hmm. each other. And obviously, Paul's vision won.
Yeah, it sure did. Well, let's welcome our phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. And our guest is Reza Aslan. He is the author of Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Sarah in Zion, hi.
Hi, thank you very, very much. When I read the New Testament when I was like in my late 20s, I was really bugged, not by the details that were conflicting, but by like the philosophy that seemed to be really conflicting and what Jesus, the different things Jesus said. And then I came across this book called The Gospel According to Jesus by Stephen Mitchell. Mm-hmm. And he said the same thing, and he had this whole theory, like his whole theory of his belief in Christianity, and he said Thomas Jefferson was the same way, was that you can tell what Jesus really said by the way you react to it when you read it, and it's so moving, it's true, you know it's true, it's enlightening. And I wonder how the history coincides with his theory.
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, I like that book. I've read it a lot, and it's certainly true that the one thing that we can say about Jesus is that he has meant many things to many people. In the 1980s, 1970s and 1980s, you had these Catholic Jesuits in Latin America who talked about Jesus as a revolutionary figure,
right,
with a preferential option for the poor, who takes up arms against the oppressor. In, you know, the 21st century in the United States, we have this fast-growing Christian community called the Prosperity Gospel. You know, these are preachers like T.D. Jakes and Joel Osteen who argue that, you know, what Jesus really wants is for you to be wealthy and
right.
materially successful.
Right.
I mean, you know, those are about as opposite of views of Jesus
so.
As you could possibly get, and
yeah.
yet they're both, you know, in a sense, equally valid interpretations. This is the real difficulty when talking about Jesus, is that when you separate Jesus the man from the Christ, which is something, of course, most Christians do not do, they obviously think of those as the same individual, and when you relieve yourself of some of that doctrinal baggage, and you look at Jesus anew, you see him for what he was, first and foremost, which is a Jew. Now, I understand. Everybody knows Jesus was a Jew. It's obvious. Everyone always says it all the time. Well, Jesus was a Jew. Of course Jesus was a Jew. But we rarely stop and actually talk about what the consequences of that fact means. The consequences of this statement, Jesus was a Jew, is that everything he said and did has to be understood in its Jewish context. If he said, I'm the Messiah, he meant the Jewish Messiah. If he spoke about, you know, certain teachings or his understanding of God, he meant the God of the Hebrew Bible. You know, that changes how you look at mm-hmm. Jesus the man. So I think that's the key. If you really want to know, if you really want to separate Jesus of Nazareth from Jesus the Christ, it's the Jewishness of Jesus that unlocks the key.
Thank you very much, Sarah, for the call. Nikita in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi. So my question is, in your book, you seem to paint a picture of Jesus's mission being to sort of, I guess, overthrow the Roman government. But my question is that the picture that the Bible is painting? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Is different, is what you mean, right?
Right.
Yeah, right. So we, again, I think it's important to, let's start with that one fact that we all have to agree on, that Jesus was a Jew. In first century Palestine, simply saying the words, I am the Messiah, is a treasonable offense. Messiah, of course, means many things to the Jews, but essentially the thing that most Jews in Jesus' time would have agreed with is that the Messiah is the descendant of King David, that his principal task is to reestablish David's kingdom on earth, and that his job is to usher in the rule of God. Well, if you are claiming to usher in the rule of God, you are claiming to usher out the rule of Caesar. They are one and the same. which is why every single person who said the phrase, I am the Messiah, in Jesus' time, both before and after him, was killed for doing so. So I think this idea, again, of, you know, trying to get past what Christians who wrote the gospel said about Jesus, who was a Jew, and focus instead on what Jesus the Jew would have said or meant by his words, is the principal thing that divides the believer from the scholar. I can tell you as we've already said before, why do the Gospels seem to present a Jesus that is a pacifist, that is not interested in the cares of this world? Because the Gospels were written to appeal to Romans, that's why.
Mm-hmm.
And the Romans were not about to follow a religion based on some itinerant Jewish preacher whose entire ministry was predicated on the reversal of the social order and the removal of the yoke of occupation from Jerusalem. So you had to temper that. It's still in the Gospels. You can't ignore it because it's part of who Jesus was, but you do have to temper it. You have to do whatever you can in order to kind of make Jesus a more celestial figure, somebody whose kingdom is not of this world. It's of a heavenly kingdom, somebody who's not interested in politics, somebody who certainly has no interest in overturning the state.
Mm-hmm. Professor Aslan, before we take a brief pause and then go back to phone calls, your book has just become this huge phenomena, as you know, in the United States. You're number one on the New York Times bestseller list, and people are talking about this book. I have friends who are running to the bookstore to get this book. Why? What's going on with all of that?
Well, it turns out people are interested in Jesus. Who knew?
I guess.
Look, I think what I'm really proud about this book is that it's captured two distinct audiences. I have hundreds of emails from Christians who have said that this book has opened up their eyes, that it has actually strengthened their faith because, you know, they go to church and they hear about Jesus the God, but they really rarely hear about Jesus the man in the world in which he lived. And while they still believe that that man was God, it's eye-opening to understand how to put his words and deeds in the context of his time. At the same time, I get hundreds of emails from non-believers who say, oh, thank you, this is the Jesus that looking for, you know, the Jesus that is not of the church. And ultimately, you know, the bottom line is that if I had any kind of agenda in writing this book, it was to show what a remarkable person this was, how you could actually be a follower of Jesus and his teachings without necessarily being a Christian. And I think that that has struck a chord for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Reza Aslan is our guest. The book is Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@WPR.org. Leave messages on our Facebook page as well where we can all read them. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls. Harry is next in Madison. Hi, Harry.
Kathleen, thank you.
Sure.
Hi, Dr. Aslan.
Hello.
Your representation that history was not known or was not understood in the same way that we do before, after Christ's death, I find a little troubling. How about the Jewish scriptures, the Jewish history of the Jewish people that was written before? And also, if Paul was so important, how did Peter become the leader of the Christian church and the first pope? And have you read the Gospel of Thomas?
Yes, I've read the Gospel of Thomas. I've read all the Gnostic Gospels. As many of your listeners may know, the four Gospels that are canonized are by no means the only Gospels that we have available to us. We have uncovered an entire library of so-called Gnostic Gospels in Upper Egypt in a town called Nag Hammadi. These include the Gospels of Philip, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of the Egyptian, etc., etc. These are mostly 2nd and 3rd and 4th century documents. Though the Gospel of Thomas is, you know, a lot of scholars would place that much, much earlier. They would say that, you know, it's kind of perhaps the early part, the first half of the 2nd century. So that question, I think, is very important. And these documents, of course, provide a vastly different view of who Jesus is than what we have in the canonized Gospels. The answer to your first question is, No, this is the case of all scriptures, the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament, the Bhagavad Gita, the Gathas, the Quran, all scriptures are sacred history, not what we would call history. You cannot read about the Prophet Muhammad or Jesus or Moses the way that you would read about Napoleon or Washington. Again, what we call history did not exist in the ancient mind. If you wanted to say something about someone in the ancient world, let's say you wanted to say that this person, Joe, is an extremely giving person, a selfless giving person, this is what you would say. One day, Joe went outside on a very cold day. He saw a homeless man naked on the street and shivering, and Joe took the shirt off of his own back and gave it to the homeless man and walked on. Now, did that story actually happen? The ancient mind wouldn't understand the question, let alone give you the right answer to it. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. But you've completely missed the point of the story, which is not the fact of it, but the truth of it, which is Joe is the kind of man who would give you the shirt off his back. That's how the Gospels were written. That's how all the scriptures were written, including the Hebrew Bible.
Thank you. Thank you, Harry. I'm sorry. You had something else?
No. I actually forgot what the second question was. I apologize.
I think it did. Well, he said something about the people who wrote the scriptures, obviously evidence of a very literary group of people, the Jewish scriptures.
Right. Well, the Hebrew scriptures, of course, were written by many, many, many hands and copied and recopied and recopied over hundreds and hundreds of years. We think of the Bible as though it's a book. It's not. It's a series of books. Each book themselves also a series of books. Let's just look at Genesis. Genesis is not one book. It's actually, by some scholars, either three or five different books that were kind of put together into a single text, written by different people over many, many different years.
Thank you, Harry, so much for your call. Daniel is next in Minong. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. People had much better memories in pre-literate societies. Do you believe the words attributed to Jesus by the writers of the Gospels were actually said by Jesus, or do you believe their narrative is largely fantasy?
Well, fantasy, again, is the wrong term for it. I mean, people, I think, misunderstand what I'm saying because they think what I'm saying is that the gospel is false, or it's not true, or it's a lie. Those are modern conceptions, and they didn't apply to the people who wrote the gospels. Again, what they were interested in is not what we would refer to as historical accuracy. What they were interested in is the revealing a message, the truth that they want to say. The gospel writers already believed that Jesus was the Messiah. They already believed, in some cases, that Jesus was God. When they set about writing their gospels, they did so in order to prove a belief that they already had, not to state some objective, bystander report of what Jesus said and did. That said, you are absolutely correct. Pre-literate societies, or primarily, I should say, oral societies like Jesus's, had far better abilities to maintain memories because that's primarily how information was shared. It wasn't written down, it was spoken. So that's true. But like a game of telephone, the problem with oral societies is that in every retelling of the story, it changes a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So Mark has Jesus say, "Blessed are the poor." And Luke has Jesus say, "Blessed are the poor in spirit."
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I mean?
Right.
So which one did Jesus actually say?
Well, he obviously meant both, right?
Right.
Thanks very much, Daniel, for your interesting call. Mary in Madison, hi.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering where in the New Testament can be found the Caesar coin, and what do you think of that passage?
I assume you're referring to the famous render unto Caesar, what is Caesar's, correct? Well, I'll just assume that that's what you meant, because I think you may have hung up the phone. That's actually something that you can find in the Synoptics, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's a very famous moment in which, after Jesus makes this triumphal entry into Jerusalem, declaring himself unambiguously as the king who has arrived to reestablish the kingdom of God on earth, after he has this provocative and violent action in the temple, where he breaks open the cages of the beasts being sold for sacrifice, kicks over the tables of the money changers and the money lenders. After that, sometimes are called Pharisees, sometimes are called scribes or elders of the law, decide that they're going to trap Jesus into giving himself away. And so they come up to him and they ask him this question: "Tell us, Master, is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar or not?" Now, this is not a simple question. It's a trap, because in Jesus' time, the quintessential mark of a zealot was his refusal to pay the tribute. In fact, that's what set the zealots apart from the rest of the Jews, is that they thought that the tribute was an abomination. They refused to pay it. So essentially what these Jews are asking Jesus is not, should we pay tribute or not? What they're saying is, are you or are you not a zealot? Mm-hmm. Jesus' answer, quite famously, is, show me the denarius coin. This is the coin that the Jews use to pay the tribute. He says, whose face is on this coin and whose name is on this coin? And the Jews say, well, it's Caesar's name. And then he says this phrase, which ever since the King James Bible has been understood as render onto, but that's not what he is saying. The Greek word apodidomi has a very specific interpretation here. It means to give back, as in give something back to someone that is theirs. So if you take something from someone and you give it back to them, you use the word apodidomi. So what Jesus is saying here is not render unto Caesar and render unto God. What he's saying is give back to Caesar the property that belongs to Caesar, this coin. It's his coin. It's got his name and his face stamped on it. But give back to God the property that belongs to God.
Oh, that's fascinating.
It's the land.
Mm-hmm.
That is about as zealous right. a statement as you can get in Jesus' time.
Yeah, fascinating. Mary, thank you. Carol in Menasha, hi.
Hi. Real quick, I had no interest in reading your book until I saw that clip of you on Fox News.
Oh, yeah.
I'm an atheist, but I find this Jesus fascinating. And I find that the social justice message of the historical Jesus, very fascinating. I'm also curious of how reliable of a source is Josephus?
Mm, very good. So Josephus, a Jewish historian who is writing at the end of the first century, writes two major chronicles, one called The Jewish War, which is a chronicle of the great Jewish revolt in 66 that I was referring to, and another one called The Antiquities of the Jews, which is much more kind of a broad history of the Jewish people meant for a Roman audience. Now, again, Josephus is an ancient person, so, you know, he is someone who has the same conception of what history means. He's not writing objectively verifiable facts, necessarily. He's trying to make a point. The difference, however, in why people rely on Josephus more so than they rely, for instance, on the Gospels, is that, at the very least, we assume that Josephus doesn't have a Christian bias. So when Josephus writes about James, the brother of Jesus, for instance, or when he mentions Jesus in an offhand way, or when he talks about John the Baptist, whom Josephus writes a lot about, John the Baptist was a very famous person,
yes,
much more famous than Jesus in both of their lifetimes, we tend to put more historical weight on Josephus's descriptions than we do on the New Testament, not because Josephus is right and the New Testament is wrong, but because we assume a different level of bias in Josephus's writings than we do and the Gospels. But make no mistake, Josephus also has a bias in his writing. He is writing for a Roman audience, and so, you know, he's got an agenda. in his writing.
And we've come to the end of the hour. Fascinating book, and thank you so much, Reza Aslan, for being with us this hour. It was great.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you for
having me. Thank you. Yeah, our great pleasure. The book is Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. Reza Aslan, an internationally acclaimed writer and scholar of religions. His first book, No God But God, The Origins, Evolution, and Future of Islam. Thanks to Rhonda Fanny and K.P. Whaley for producing this hour. A reminder, we'll be with you again tomorrow. We'll be speaking with Thurston Clark about his book, JFK's Last 100 Days. And also a reminder, tonight, Eugene Schultz, who celebrated his 90th birthday, has had some incredible World War II experiences, including uncovering the first concentration camp. He is going to be at Boswell Books talking about his book, The Ghost in General Patton's Third Army, tonight at 7 o'clock. I'll be there. It's free. It's open to the public, and we hope you'll attend.